Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Beiser, and tonight I am speaking with the creative director for Logic Artists. Please welcome to the podcast, Jonas Waver.
Yeah, hello. Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Hi, Jonas. It's a pleasure to have you on tonight.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
Cool. All right. Now, Logic Artists is the developer behind the game Expeditions Conquistadors, which was also a Kickstarter title, and you guys are also currently working on a new game called Clandestine. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct, yes.
And we'll be talking about both those games in a few minutes. To get things rolling then, Jonas, for people who may not have heard of Logic Artists and your team, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your studio?
Yeah, of course. Logic Artists is a fairly small independent studio located in Copenhagen in Denmark. We are 15 developers in the office, and we were started 3 years ago. So yeah, that's pretty much it. I'm the creative director here, so I'm the lead designer on our games. I write all of the text and the dialogue and so on, and generally oversee the troops.
Cool. Now, one question for you, Jonas. How is the video game scene in Copenhagen? Because I've spoken to a few other developers in Denmark. I believe Stefan from Beta Dwarf. Mm-hmm, but I'm just curious, how is game development going on over there? Because I'm located on the east coast of the U.S., and it's always interesting to hear how the game industry is going in other countries.
Oh, well, it's not bad here. I would say we have a fair few companies here, but they tend to be quite small. Mm-hmm. We have one major game studio, IO Interactive, who you know from the Hitman series.
Yeah.
Other than that, it's sort of medium tier. There's like a handful of medium tier studios. I think we're among them. And then there's a whole bunch of rather small studios that are sort of up and coming. There's a lot of mobile development here and a lot of sort of arty indie studios. Mm-hmm. We consider ourselves to be more of either the upper end of the studio, the smaller studio group, or the lower end of the medium studio group. So we kind of try to run kind of a professional mm-hmm. work environment, but at the same time, we are pretty indie and kind of new. So, yeah.
Okay. Now, looking at your site, obviously, the main game that you worked on was Expeditions Conquistadors, and you guys are working on Clandestine. Now, mm-hmm. for your studio, do you guys have any, like, set types of games that you like to work on? Or is it just, you know, whatever game genres or mechanics that you find interested in at the time?
Yeah, it's an obvious question because those two games are really different from each other. Essentially, we're an RPG studio. We'd like mm-hmm. to sort of establish ourselves as an RPG studio. Originally, Clandestine was sort of intended to be more of an RPG as well. However, we just ended up following the design in the direction that we thought would benefit the game most, and it ended up being a completely different type of game than we expected. But we're pretty happy with how it turned out. Essentially, we're an RPG studio, and that's the angle we're coming at game development from.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, the RPG genre has definitely gone in a lot of different directions these days. There's, of course, the classic debate over, you know, JRPG versus CRPG design. And there's a lot more in terms of, like, nuance in the genre these days with tactical RPGs and whatnot. For you, Jonas, in your studio, what type of RPGs or RPG systems do you generally like to deal with?
We are definitely more in the Western RPG tradition. Our main inspirations are studios like Black Isle and mm-hmm. Obsidian and BioWare, and that kind of group of Dungeons & Dragons inspired RPGs, essentially. We're obviously interested in all kinds of games, and there's many here who enjoy Japanese RPGs as well, but we tend to do sort of the more nerdy kind of turn-based, top-down, really sort of character-driven RPGs.
Interesting. We've seen a lot of interesting development come from the Western style. Now, with Expeditions Conquistadors, we'll probably talk about this a little bit more in a few minutes, but from looking at the game, I can definitely see the RPG side to it, but there's also the strategic side and the resource management. I know a lot of people were sort of comparing to a light version of like XCOM or other mm-hmm. tactical strategy games. For you, Jonas, was there any like I guess, tactical or strategy design that you like to involve in these types of games?
Yeah, one of our most sort of strategy-based inspirations for, I mean, obviously we did take a bunch of inspiration from Heroes of Might and Magic and all of the games in that genre. We also tended to bring up the Rainbow Six series. That's probably not something you'd expect when you play the game, but just the roster system, the way you select your troops and sort of send them into battle, and then they can get injured for a while and stuff like that. That was very inspired by Rainbow Six. Once XCOM came out, which was about halfway through Conquistador's development, I mean the new XCOM. We took a hard look at that and grabbed a bunch of usability stuff from that. I thought they did a great job updating the old franchise to more modern sort of sensibilities. So we took a bunch of inspiration from that as well. In general, though, our main inspirations were games like Fallout 2, especially, and all of the old sort of BioWare and Black Isle RPGs.
Okay. Now, moving on then, let's talk a little bit more about the Kickstarter, as well as we'll get a little bit more in depth with Expeditions. So, the Kickstarter for Expeditions Conquistadors, this was your studio's first Kickstarter, as well as your first game.
Yeah.
And I have a few general questions regarding the platform that I'd like to ask all the developers we have on for it. So, first question for you, Jonas, is when you guys were coming up with the concept and design for Expeditions Conquistadors, was this a game that you were dead set on going onto Kickstarter from the get-go, or did the option sort of arise during the game's early development?
I would say the option arose during early development. Originally, we didn't really have any plans for how to fund the game. We just sort of started working on it and hoped for the best. Originally, it was a university project, and when we started the studio, we weren't actually really intending to make our own games because we thought that seemed like it would be really difficult, especially to begin with. So we were trying to do work for hire, except, you know, it's really hard to get work for hire when you haven't made any games yet. So that's how we just ended up picking this old university project, because we thought that would make a great full-fledged game. And then we just sort of started working on it because we had the team, we had the office, and we needed something to do. And then while we were ramping up development of that, we started looking around for options for how to actually gain funding for it. And at that time, that was right around the time when Tim Schafer had done his first Kickstarter, and Pillars of Eternity was going up, I think.
Yeah.
So Kickstarter was really taking off in the gaming space. And we felt like that was a train we had to jump on, and that would really give us the opportunity we needed to finish the game.
Yeah. And I hear similar stories with a lot of new developers or indie startups over the last few years who really took to Kickstarter and crowdfunding for their first projects. Now, after it's been a few years since you guys did that, what did you think, or what do you think about crowdfunding in general after going through the campaign and working on a game using the funding from that?
I still think it's really valuable. I think it's really valuable to the developers, and I actually think it's quite valuable to the players as well. As a Kickstarter backer, I really enjoy that feeling of interconnectedness with the people that I back, and the feeling that I'm in on something right from the start. As a developer, I think it's obviously an amazing opportunity to fund your own projects without having to sell your soul and your firstborn and all your plans for the next 10 years to a publisher. But at the same time, what surprised me about it is the real gain of it is actually just the community that comes almost built in with a Kickstarter campaign.
Yeah, and I agree with you on that, Jonas. I recently spoke with the developer Greg Johnson, who's working on a Kickstarter for the game, a spiritual sequel to the classic series Toe Jim and Earl, and he basically just mirrored your same thoughts, that it's great about how much you can build a community and really interact with the fans with Kickstarter and crowdfunding compared to the old days of the industry where everything had to be run through a PR agency or publisher and all that. And today, the huge amount of transparency has been one of the biggest factors, I think, with the popularity of the indie market and really with crowdfunding these days, too.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's great, and especially because since we ran our Kickstarter, we have been shopping around for publishers for further projects. We ended up just going for self-publishing for Clandestine as well. Mm-hmm. And it really puts into perspective how horrible many of these publisher deals actually are. Mm. And it's fair. I mean, they give you all the money to make the game. They take all the risk. And of course, you know, they expect to get all of the reward as well. But mm-hmm. you still feel like you are the one who puts all of the energy in, all of the creativeness, creativity, and it doesn't quite feel fair that you then have almost no chance to actually getting anything out of it in the end.
And the publisher developer interaction has been a very interesting topic. It's one that a lot of people who either play video games or study them probably don't hear too much about, because it's really more about, you know, the back off inner workings type deal. We've heard a lot of horror stories over the last few years about publisher relationships. Some people have great relations with their publishers, but then there's always those cases where you hear of an indie developer getting screwed due to a bad publisher deal, or the publisher just flat out not doing what they agreed to.
Yeah. I think once you, like, that's another benefit to Kickstarter, because if you approach a publisher and you already have a game, you already funded it yourself, then the deals get a lot better. And that makes sense, right? Because then you took all the risk, you spent all the money, and then, of course, you're almost hiring them to do the parts of game release that you don't have the competences to do. So you get them to do marketing and and distribution and so on. And then it's a much more sort of equal relationship. So that's another great benefit to Kickstarter, is it enables that kind of partnership instead.
And as you said, Jonas, when they're just dealing with the PR, it's a whole different story when they're expecting to, you know, fit the bill or foot the bill for millions of dollars. And one of the things that we're really seeing in the market these days is just how important good PR is. There's been a huge amount or a huge influx of indie developers over the last 5 years. And one of the things that we're seeing is that it's becoming a lot harder to stand out from the crowd. And that's where having a very good PR comes in. We've spoken with a lot of developers who have really had to push themselves to be either like the face of their company or to take more of a direct handle on their PR. Because if you try to release a game without anyone knowing what it is, it doesn't matter if it's a really damn good game. If no one knows what it is, no one's going to buy it. And in this market, that can really be a studio killer if you're not too careful.
Yeah, that's something we're struggling with a lot as well, is that we have one PR guy in the office and he's doing a great job, but it's limited what he can do compared to these large AAA studios that have entire divisions. And we're still sort of trying to get into how, you know, especially because we don't really give him any money to work with. We end up spending all our money on development all the time, making the game better, finishing it and so on. So we end up having no money left to actually market it. And we're really, as well, working hard to find ways to gain awareness and build community without necessarily having a lot of money to throw at that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and that's also one of the other benefits I hear about Kickstarter and even Early Access, which I know Clandestine is on at the moment, is that you can really build a community using without having to go too far into PR. We've spoken to other developers who loved how much Kickstarter has allowed them to build this community of fans who then go out and basically spread the word about the game and essentially be free advertising. And that's something that pretty much is invaluable to any game developer these days.
Yeah, building a group of advocates who can help you spread the word and essentially sell your game to other players just because they love it so much. That's what everyone wants to do, right? That's the gold mine.
Definitely. Now, getting back to Expeditions and your Kickstarter. Now, of course, you guys did this Kickstarter in 2012, as we said, during what was really the big boom on the Kickstarter market. Now, being 2015, the market for Kickstarter has definitely changed. You said a few minutes ago, Jonas, that you were or still are a big fan of the crowdfunding model. Has your impressions of it changed as the market or as crowdfunding has evolved over the last 3 years?
I would say it seems like Kickstarter backers at least are getting a bit more careful with their with who they back. And I think that's both natural and completely fair. I think there's been some uncertainty about certain projects, but I don't necessarily think that's an unhealthy thing. I think it's good that people are being a little more skeptical about who they back, and it just seems like it may have slowed down a little, but we'll see if it's temporary, right? Because it's possible that once the first wave of games, once they're all out and people have a better picture of how many of them turned out well compared to how many of them didn't, then maybe it'll pick up a little again. Maybe people will sort of regain a bit of their faith in the platform.
Okay. Now, I figure since we are talking about crowdfunding and new models of game development, we'll talk a little bit about early access as well, just so we keep everything in the same section. Now, as I said a few seconds ago, Clandestine is on early access on Steam. And this is another new model that has really taken root over the last 3-4 years. Steam has been trying to push this, and we've seen interesting discussions about it, both positive and negative. For you, Jonas, what do you think about the early access model and how it compares to Kickstarter or general crowdfunding?
So I personally really like early access, and I suspect that's what you expected me to say. But I come out of the modding community, as well as a couple other people here in the office, and we're very used to this kind of system where you announce your project way before it's actually slated for release, and then people have a chance to jump on board with that and help out in little ways or provide feedback and follow along with your development. To me, it seems like early access is just the sort of professional extension of that modding dynamic. And it really appeals to me because as a developer, especially, it basically gives you the other half of what Kickstarter gives you. So for Clandestine, we chose not to do a Kickstarter because we had all the funding. We didn't really need to go out and ask people for money, but we still wanted that to build that kind of community before release. We still wanted to build a little momentum. We still wanted a chance to put the game in front of people's eyes and get their impressions on it. And that's what it seemed to us that early access was all about, right? It's the community building part of Kickstarter without necessarily the money collecting part.
Now, one thing that I find interesting with speaking to different developers like yourself, Jonas, is how a lot of the newer indie studios who have started up in like the last 5-6 years have really taken to these new models like Kickstarter and Early Access. But when I speak to some of the older developers, some of the quote-unquote old guard, they're ones who are a little bit more apprehensive about these types of models, probably because they're more used to the traditional game development. Now, with Early Access, how have you guys like dealt with the fans, or how has the fan reaction been to working on the game while selling it on the Early Access model?
The people who have actually bought into it have been quite positive. We have really good reviews on Early Access, and the comments we're getting, like almost all of them seem to really get what the game is about, which is all you can really hope for. They want to see it, you know, they want us to take it in the same direction as we want to take it, which is great. Of course, there's not been as much uptake on it as we would have liked. And I think that's partially because there's been a few high profile failures on early access over the past 3 or 4 months. And I guess our timing was kind of bad in that respect, because people had just lost basically all of their faith in the early access model. And then we come out, go, hey, buy us.
Yeah. I've heard the same thing from other developers. When I spoke with like Zach Barth from Zachtronics, he talked about how he's been looking at the model. And again, as you said, Jones, this last, I would say like 2014 was not a good year for early access, because a lot of the games that came out either underperformed, there's a whole space-based DF9 fiasco, and there's a lot more losers than there are winners on the platform, but the winners who do stand out, like Prison Architect, like Kerbal Space Program, I think that one's almost done or is done, and other titles, when you have a big hit, it can do amazingly well. And we've seen a lot of developers really been able to thrive off of that. But then, as you said, Jonas, it's just very hard to stand out, not only from other great games, but to try to distance yourself from the games that have failed and have shown, you know, the failings of the platform.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there really are more losers than winners on the platform, or if it's just that the losers tend to gather more publicity and stand out more. I mean, people remember being disappointed perhaps better than they remember having their expectations met, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, maybe one of the problems is people come to early access expecting, well, developers come to early access expecting to use it as almost like a way to raise capital, right? They expect to get the money part of Kickstarter out of it as well. And I think you'd be much better off just having an almost finished product, having, you know, knowing that you have both the time and the money to actually pull it off, even if you have zero sales on early access. And then just using the early access platform as a way to essentially, like an open beta almost, a way to actually get more players, even if, you know, you're a smaller company like us, you may not have the resources to bring 100 people into the game studio to just play the game every week.
All right. Now, one final question for you, Jonas, about crowdfunding in general, and then we'll move on talking more about Expeditions and then Clandestine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with both models, this is a question that I like to ask a lot of our developers who come on. What do you think about the future of crowdfunding, either Kickstarter, Early Access, or both, when it comes to sustainability? This is another one of those topics that we've heard interesting discussions from both sides. Some people feel that the models have a long future for game development. Others feel that in its current state, it may not last too long and may need to change with the times. So what are your opinions on that, Jonas?
Okay, well, talking about the future is a great way to be quoted a couple years later as one of those, look at all these people who have no idea what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, my hope is that people will sort of figure out how it works and settle into a sort of the right mindset for this kind of platform. Because I think ultimately it's about maybe the expectations of the backers are different from either from the realities of game development, which can be harsh and disappointing. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's more a question of making sure that the backers are on the same page as the developers, essentially. And I think that's why I'm saying the skepticism that we're seeing now is not necessarily unhealthy. I think it's a good thing that people are a little more aware of the dangers now, and it may cause them to be a little more picky with what projects they support and which projects they don't, which is kind of how it should be, I think.
All right.
Just to summarize, I feel like once people settle into the right mindset, I think that the platform will get more stable. The whole system of crowdfunding will stabilize a little bit. That's what I'm hoping.
All right, cool. Now, one just completely tangent-related question. I was just wondering, Jonas, what are your thoughts on, like, one of the other big pushes we've been seeing over the last few years is augmented reality, VR, the Oculus Rift. And I was just wondering, what are your impressions on it, from a studio standpoint? Because this is another one of the things that when we spoke to a lot of newer indie developers, they've been really excited about it. And another thing, when we speak to a lot of older developers, they're like, maybe I'll wait and see on it.
Yeah, I think that's because apparently there was a VR crash 10 years ago or something.
Yeah.
and all of the old guard, I suppose, were part of that and lost a lot of money on it or their jobs. And that's obviously, when you've experienced that, that'll make you cautious in the future. Mm-hmm. I'm excited about it. Unfortunately, I haven't really had a chance to try any of it out myself. I completely managed to miss any VR demonstrations at GDC last week. But from what I've read about it and from what I understand of it, I think it seems really, really exciting and really interesting. And I'm a huge fan of Looking Glass Studios, which had this really hardcore paradigm of immersion and just trying to make you feel like mm-hmm. you were in their game worlds and you had a modicum of freedom to explore and do what you wanted. And I can just see virtual reality being perfect for that kind of thing. I'm a little more uncertain about augmented reality because to me, that seems better suited for smaller sort of mini games or mobile games and stuff. That's cool too, but it's less my thing, I would say.
Okay. And also, as an indie developer, What are your thoughts on the other big push we're seeing is Steam trying to essentially create a PC for the living room with like the Steam Box and essentially trying to bridge these two markets that have been for a very long time completely separate in terms of fans and really in terms of, you know, the money that goes into them?
To me, the value of the Steam Box isn't so much in bringing the computer into the living room, because my computer is already in my living room, and I've been playing a lot of games on it with an Xbox controller hooked up to it and my TV connected via HDMI. So that won't really make a difference to me. I can see, though, how that would be really cool to people who don't have that option. To me, the value of the Steam Box, at least the promise of the Steam Box, is that we'll finally get... It'll make it easier to develop Linux games. Conquistador was released for Linux, and we had a hell of a time with that, in a bad way. That was really difficult because there's so many distros, and you know, things were working great on our test machines, but then one of the other 800 distros available had graphical glitches and crashes, and the mouse didn't work and stuff like that. And it's impossible to test all of those different configurations, and there's so big differences between them as well. So to me, I think what really excites me about Steambox is I hope that it'll be accepted as the Linux gaming platform, so that it'll make it possible for us to release our future games on Linux as well, because otherwise we've pretty much written off that OS.
Okay, interesting. With that, I think let's move on and talk more about your studio's games, including Expeditions and Clandestine. So now that we've spent the first part of our cast talking more about the industry and general running type questions, let's get back to talking about your games, Jonas, and we'll start with Expeditions. So, as we said at the beginning of the cast, you and your studio are focusing more on the RPG side of mechanics and design, but you also threw in some strategic gameplay with Expeditions. To get things rolling on this part of our discussion, where did the overall concept for Expeditions come from?
Yeah, so that's actually a pretty funny story. I had this university course, which was about user experience and prototyping, and the task that they set for us for the whole course was that at the end of it, we would have to develop a game for a target audience of one person and then do, you know, the most focused possible user experience testing with just that target audience of one person. And I chose to make a game for my mom because she enjoys video games, and that seemed like a fun challenge. There were various parameters that I sort of deduced from that, and one of them was that, you know, she enjoys exploration in games. She plays a lot of Minecraft, and I enjoy exploration as well. So it seemed like I would make a game that was specifically about exploration, and that became kind of the foundation of the whole game. That with every decision that we made, it had to support this overall aesthetic of being an exploratory game. That's how the setting came, because if there's any greater project of exploration throughout human history than the Spanish Conquista, then I can't name it. And that's also how the whole resource management system and the strategy side of it came, because exploration is dangerous and you're in foreign lands with little resources that must be carefully managed and so on. So all of that kind of came together that way.
Okay. Now, the setting for the game taking place during Spain's expeditions to the Americans is a very interesting setting that we don't see too many game developers go for. Was the setting like a major part of the original design, or was this another element that was sort of added in as you started to get rolling on the game?
It was added very early. I think I settled on it before I even started programming anything. And it was right there in the university prototype, and it was one of the things that made it so promising to us when we had to pick a project to pursue for Logic Artists. Because I agree, it's a very unique and unusual setting. I think there's very few games in that setting, and they're quite old. And we could definitely see the appeal of an RPG that wasn't a traditional sort of fantasy or sci-fi role-playing game. At the same time, we could bring in little aspects of mythology from that area and make sure that it's not, you know, no offense, a dry historical game either, that there's a bit of room for imagination and so on. So it was right there from the beginning, and it's one of the things that made it so enjoyable to work with as well.
Yeah. Now, one other interesting aspect of the game is the characters that you have in the title and how you form your expedition from these preset characters, and then each one has different pros and cons and whatnot. As you guys were coming up with the character designs, what was like the general philosophy or thought process behind how these characters were going to be used in the game or how they would apply to the mechanics that you had set?
Yeah, the characters are almost like a resource themselves. Mm-hmm. That ties into the resource management philosophy of the game in general. They're your units, but at the same time, they represent different aspects of the general sort of mentality of that period and that setting. Mm-hmm. They're racist or open-minded, they're religious or non-religious, they're aggressive or they're peaceful, they're courageous or they're cowardly. So each character sort of represents an aspect of the historical mindset, and therefore mm-hmm. they support both the gameplay dynamics of choosing sides in conflicts to favor different party members over others, and they also support the sort of narrative aesthetic of exploring the ethics and morality of a completely different kind of culture.
Mm-hmm. Now, one interesting conversation I heard a few people talk about when the game was released was regarding having female characters or female troops back during that era. And I was just wondering, was this something that was added in for like diversity's sake, or was it something that you guys didn't even like think about, you know, just put into the game just because kind of deal?
Well, as mentioned, the original target audience was my mom, mm-hmm. And therefore the original player character, when we didn't have an actual choice, mm-hmm. was a woman.
Okay.
And you know, we stuck with that because we wanted to be, you know, inviting and inclusive,
yeah.
and we wanted everyone to have a good time and feel like the game was made for someone like them. And you know, my argument about the women is, first of all, it brings a lot of diversity to the story that mm-hmm. might otherwise be missing, and it makes it a little more interesting in some respects. Mm-hmm. And secondly, you can choose not to bring any women in your party. There are more than 50% mm-hmm. more followers than you need to fill your party entirely with men.
Yeah.
So if you don't want that aspect, you know, you can more or less select not to get it.
Yeah. And that's a good point, Jones, about, you know, having in there as an option for people who can either embrace it, or if there are any detractors, they can just simply ignore it. But it definitely seems like the game is stronger for having that option.
Yeah, it also ties in with the sort of alternate reality, alternate history nature of the game. I mean, it isn't a historical game. We didn't want it to be completely like a simulation of history. We have mythological elements in there. I'm not going to spoil any of them, but they involve gods. And generally, they can be explained away. If you don't like historical elements, you can sort of imagine them as being results of poisonous fumes or psychedelic mushrooms and stuff. So we are kind of straddling the balance between fantasy and history here, definitely with a bias towards history, but still allowing ourselves some creative liberties in that respect.
Okay. Now, talking about the character designs and the overall aesthetic of the game, one thing that I really did enjoy were like the still paintings that you guys use for either like cutscenes or like text areas or for the different characters themselves. For these different stills, was this something that you guys created, or how did you essentially put these stills in the game?
Yeah, so the game was pretty text-based. It's one of the strengths, but also one of the weaknesses of the game is that a lot of it is conveyed through just descriptions. And we thought that was pretty dry in many ways. So obviously we wanted to add illustrations as a way to spice it up a little and kind of sell the atmosphere. So we found this amazing Turkish illustrator mm-hmm. Who actually was kind of a friend of a friend. And he made all these things for us. He made all of the portraits and he made all of the illustrations. And we sent him, you know, lists of settings where events would take place, situations that we wanted to be illustrated, like burning native villages or a battlefield or moving onto a beach and so on. And then he drew all these beautiful, beautiful illustrations for us. And he, you know, he took a few iterations to kind of get into the style of it. It was a bit more cartoony in the beginning, but eventually he sort of worked out this very painterly style that really fits the sort of Renaissance setting. Yeah. We're really happy with him, and we've actually used him in Clandestine as well, and we'll probably be using him in the next Expeditions game too.
Cool. Yeah, like I said, it just really looks amazing. As you said, it just really ties into the overall setting of the game as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with the gameplay of Expeditions, as we said, it's part RPG, it's part resource management, and the other side of the game is the exploration, or dealing with exploring the different areas, trying to keep resources up, and all that. In terms of that type of mechanics and that design philosophy, where did the idea come from to have this like exploration angle? Some people sort of compare like something like the Oregon Trail and other type of survival-esque games.
Yeah, the Oregon Trail, despite none of us having ever played it, was actually a major inspiration for it. Because even though we haven't played it, we've of course read a bunch about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what it was originally like, the game. I mean, the University Project had almost no RPG stuff in it. It had resource management, it had text events, and you basically clicked on a 2D map, you went there with your avatar, and there would be a little pop-up explaining stuff. But we all just really like RPGs, and we really wanted to make an RPG, and we could really see the game working well as an RPG, so it actually kind of happened that way around, that we added all of the RPG mechanics, the turn-based combat, the character management, the whole sort of morality thing. We added that to the strategy part.
Okay, interesting. Now, speaking about the combat system, this was another system of the game that I wanted to spend a few minutes on, because I liked it, but I also had a few issues with, I guess, melee versus range. It felt like melee was always a superior option, just due to movement radiuses and general attack accuracy. For you, Jonas, and your team, how did you guys develop the turn-based combat portion of Expeditions?
It started out with a paper prototype, I believe, and we just implemented the simplest possible version of it, and then went from there. The reason why we have this big difference between ranged and melee is that melee uses attacks of opportunity to kind of trap you in combat. So as soon as you move up to someone, you have to actually spend a fair amount of action points. You basically give up your turn if you want to move away without taking a hit.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, that needs to be balanced out by some sort of ranged problem, right? I mean, because otherwise ranged would be overpowered.
Yeah.
And that's why we decided not to give melee a missed chance. And actually, I think melee is, obviously it feels a lot more useful because it's more reliable.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember the numbers right now, but I think it balances out pretty well. But the problem is that when it seems like unreliability is way more of a negative thing to players than damage per second, for example.
Yeah.
So even if the damage per second is the same, even if the overall benefit is the same, it still is a less attractive option when you don't know exactly what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a lesson learned there, and we'll be revisiting that in further installations of the series.
Yeah. It's an interesting point about it, Jonas, that perception of, miss or losing a turn versus a guaranteed hit. It's a good discussion point for a lot of RPG designs. It's something that I've been seeing when I play the game The Darkest Dungeon, which is another Kickstarter title, and how when you have these different options, one of the most attractive option is the one that's guaranteed to hit. It's like saying, would you rather hit for 2 to 3 points of damage 100% or 6 to 9, but it only has a 30% chance to hit? People are going to go with the sure thing, even though the stronger hit may end combat a little quicker. But that perception of, do I do a little bit of damage, or do I just completely miss and, throw this turn out? What do I do? And it's just a very unpopular option to throw away a turn.
Yeah, and also, smack-talking your customers is generally a bad idea, but people aren't very good at understanding or sort of instinctively grasping probability.
Mm-hmm.
If you have an 80% chance to hit, that reads to everyone as 100% chance to hit.
Oh, yeah.
And if they, it means there's there's a decent probability they'll miss twice in a row. It's not high, but it's far from unlikely. Mm-hmm. And once that happens, you immediately go, oh, the game is cheating. They had an 80% hit chance and I lost twice in a row. That's because the game is cheating. Even if it's just, you know, that's how probability works. Sometimes you get those bad rolls. Oh, so that's a big problem in RPG design.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I know a thing about getting bad rolls. Playing any kind of RPG with, like, probability or percent chances, I'm the guy who will, like, miss, like, four times in a row with, like, an 80% chance hit, and you can just watch me sitting there going, son of a bitch, what the hell is going on? And I've had, like, recordings of Darkest Dungeon where it's just me missing, like, four or five times in a row. And
yeah, I think Sid Meier actually had this piece of advice once where you have to cheat in the player's favor, because otherwise the player will assume that you're cheating in the game's favor. Mm-hmm. So it's like you kind of have to balance the scales in the player's favor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as I was just saying, I hear like the same thing with like anyone who plays or watching forums of any kind of RPG or probability-based game. You're always going to have people go, I missed five times at 90%. This game is broken, you know, screw the developers and all mm-hmm. that.
Exactly.
Now, with Expeditions, another part of the game that I found interesting, as we said, was combining these really three completely different systems. You have the character progressions and dealing with them, you have the exploration, and then you have the actual turn-based combat. And this is one of the things I knew attracted a lot of people, especially myself, who were used to growing up playing the older games like XCOM, who had these different these completely different mechanics and systems all combined. During development of Expeditions, when did it like sort of start to come together, when these three completely different mechanics sort of began to gel or mesh?
Yeah, we started by developing the combat and the exploration layers separately. So we had two programmers at that point, and one of them was working on the exploration and one was working on combat. And we had 2 or 3 months of development there where we just didn't have a game. And it was starting to get a little depressing. And then one day we were sort of ready. We had to combine these two sort of prototypes. And immediately, you know, we suddenly had a playable game. And it was almost, you know, I wouldn't say it was almost finished because it wasn't. But it felt like we advanced by 4 or 5 months overnight, right? Because all of a sudden everything was just assembled. Mm-hmm. That's how it stayed for a while. We just gradually added features. We had a very basic feature set. We just kept adding features and content. Mm-hmm. And then at some point, we decided that the character progression had to be a thing. And then we just redirected development towards that. That was actually fairly late, this whole leveling up and buying passive abilities and stuff. That came actually after the Kickstarter, I believe.
Okay. Now, here's another interesting question that I like to ask a lot of our developers who come on, and it has to do with figuring out when your game is done, or as you said, when do you have a game? Because this is another one of those interesting topics that I think is good for enthusiasts and students to hear, is during development, as you said, it can be months before you have what could be considered something playable or something interesting to show people. For you, Jones, during development of Expeditions, or just in game design generalize, when do you feel the game is done, or when do you feel you have something there that you can show other people?
That depends a lot on how development ends up. With Conquistador, we didn't really have a playable prototype when we started the Kickstarter, but we realized that we needed one. And at that point, you just basically have to make the decision, okay, we know when we need this to be playable. We need it to be playable 2 weeks from now. So what is the list of things that we absolutely have to have in there? What is the polish that we need and so on? And having a deadline just is, that's the key. I think that's what you need to make that happen, because then the question answers itself. Mm-hmm. You're done with the game when you're out of time.
All right, before we move on to Clandestine, just a quick few more questions about Expeditions. And one, as you said a few minutes ago, you guys are thinking about doing a sequel or continuing the series. Is there any like interesting movement on that front that fans may want to hear about or would be excited about?
Yes, Unfortunately, we are not ready to reveal anything yet, but I can say that we're working on it and that we will have an announcement fairly soon.
Awesome. Well, I'm sure we'll be excited about that. Mm-hmm. And I guess my final question regarding Expeditions for you, Jones, is after, you know, it's been a few since the game's been out, we've talked about how the design was built upon, iterated, and all that. Are there any, like, using, you know, hindsight and all that, are there any elements that you would change now if you knew about them during development?
Oh, I have a giant, giant list of things that I wanted to change. And I mean, that's the beauty of getting to develop a sequel, right? Is you can fix all those mistakes. Okay. I think mainly a lot of our mistakes stemmed from unfamiliarity with the game engine. I mean, we'd actually all used it several times before, but we'd never really pushed. We used Unity. We'd never really had a chance to push it to its limits. Mm-hmm. And as a result, we made a lot of decisions just based on lack of knowledge of it. And it's not, you know, there's some technical issues with the game in general. You'll find stories of people frying their graphics cards on it. And, you know, it doesn't look like the kind of game that would fry your graphics card. Mm-hmm. And now that we've done Clandestine and we really have pushed Unity completely to its limits and way above that, unfortunately, we're much more comfortable with what it can do and what we can do with it. And there's a lot of mistakes in there that we won't be making in the future.
Cool. All right. So with that, let's move on to our final topic and talk more about Clandestine. So to begin with, Jonas, we've been hinting at it throughout this cast, but for people who haven't heard the game, could you tell us, like, what is Clandestine about?
Yes, that's my favorite topic. Clandestine is a two-player co-op, asymmetrical co-op, stealth action spy game. It's set in 1996, and the hook is that two players can play it together, one as the spy and one as the hacker who sits in the van somewhere outside the mission perimeter, guiding the spy through the level, opening doors, disabling security cameras, hacking servers, and getting information. And that's a really, you know, cool and unique gameplay hook that we're super excited about working with.
Yeah, whenever we see, like, asymmetrical co-op design, it can really, you know, spark a lot of interest in the game. I remember when Splinter Cell unveiled their co-op stealth mode and that type of thing, that was a very interesting idea and got a lot of people interested in the series who were just looking at it as a single-player stealth game to begin with. So, with Clandestine, as you said, you have two players. One is basically in the facility doing all the action. One's in the van doing the hacking and all that. How do, like, the two basically, like, interact with each other? Or where does the cooperation come in?
Yeah, so because they all play in the same game world, they just see the world from completely different perspectives. They're both basically working on the same problem. They are basically working on the problem, how do I get from outside into this place, how do I get this information and get back out without dying? Mm-hmm. And one character has the physical presence. They have the gun. They have the ability to change the game world directly by, you know, shooting, opening doors, so on. The other player has an interface-based view of the game world where they see the map with all the little enemy icons that they've tagged. They see the sort of network view that displays the infrastructure of the game. And they're still working towards the same thing. They still need to get the spy into this place to do this thing, except they do it by manipulating the game world through all of the electronic systems and so on and so forth. So to us, ensuring that it still felt like a co-op game was about making sure that there's plenty of things that you need to rely on the other player to do, and making sure that you can see the effects of the other player's actions in your part of the game, so that you always feel connected in that sense.
Interesting. Now, the levels that the players are going through, are these levels pre-built? Are they randomly or procedurally generated or something else?
They are pre-built. We use a bunch of randomization of locations for cameras and enemies and so on to make sure that if you play with someone else who has already completed the level before, that they still need to rely on you, for example, if you're the hacker, or you need to rely on them if you're the spy. because you never really know where it's going to put that one camera. You never really know which path the enemy is going to take. So we use randomization to ensure replayability and also to ensure that you don't you never make the other character irrelevant if mm-hmm. you've already played the mission before.
Okay. In terms of like a general play, how big are the maps, or like how long does it typically take a team to get through a level?
Yeah, our goal was 45 minutes per storyline mission. We're finding that the game takes a bit longer to play than we thought, though. Mm-hmm. So I think about an hour per level is expectable. Right now we have 4 challenge maps on early access. We don't have any of the storyline maps out because we didn't want to release those before we had the voice acting in the bag. Mm-hmm. And the challenge maps are supposed to be smaller and more sort of self-contained levels that have randomly, randomized objectives so you can play them again and again. Mm-hmm. And I think those take 20 to 30 minutes to complete each. So I wouldn't be surprised if it takes about an hour to play each level in the storyline.
Okay. Now, you already mentioned how the hacker can interact with the levels, viewing the cameras, opening and closing doors, and basically keeping an eye on the spy. What options does the spy have when they're in the levels, or what is their moveset made of?
When you're the spy, you're playing much as a sort of traditional stealth game. You have various different speeds you can move at that make different kinds of noise. Mm-hmm. You have a cover system that you can use to reduce your profile and to protect yourself if you get in a firefight, which is inadvisable. Mm-hmm. You have stealth takedowns that are either lethal or non-lethal. You have a pistol, mm-hmm. which has various different ammunition types. You can use lethal or non-lethal ammo. You can use more exotic types of ammo that I don't want to spoil. Mm-hmm. And you have a set of gadgets that are designed to be kind of, realistic in a sense. They're down to earth. They're not, sci-fi future gadgets mm-hmm. like you might expect in Splinter Cell. No offense to Splinter Cell, it's a great game. They're more sort of, there are different kinds of grenades. They're like a surveillance camera disguised as a smoke detector, that kind of thing. A pager mm-hmm. that you can throw to create distractions and so on.
Okay. Now, you mentioned a few things so regarding the stealth and the combat, that in terms of the stealth design of Clandestine, it's a game that you really want to avoid combat. In terms of, developing the spy's features, is playing as a spy, are you going to be more focused on taking down enemies stealthily, or is it more like you want to avoid combat completely? Like, you want to never get close enough to an enemy to do anything because you don't want that to come back to bite you.
Our goal is to enable the player to complete each level without taking anyone down. Mm-hmm. We will see, depending on user testing, whether that ends up being actually possible. Because mm-hmm. we don't want to create too much of a focused stealth experience. We don't want to create stealth puzzles. Mm-hmm. Our design philosophy is a bit more in the vein of Looking Glass, as I mentioned before. It's a bit more about making these open, almost playground-structured mm-hmm. levels where the structure of the level and the patterns of the patrols, they kind of make a sort of in-game sense, and it's up to you to poke it and see what happens. So that makes it more difficult to ensure that you can always bypass enemies without killing them. But, we're trying to give you the feature set that you need to do it that way.
Yeah. And that definitely sounds like a smart decision, Jones, about giving the player these options and then letting them sort of dictate the flow of the game, as opposed to designing it as, a completely hardcore stealth game, or as, completely run and gun, I'm just going to run around and just stealth kill all the enemies and then the level's completely clear type thing.
Yeah. One thing that's really going to help you in that respect is we have this social engineering sequences that I haven't mentioned before. Mm-hmm. Levels have public spaces and security spaces. There's high and low security. Mm-hmm. And as long as you're in low profile mode, which means you're not wearing the full bulletproof vest and hip holster. Mm-hmm. If you're wearing a low profile, you're incognito. You can move around unobstructed in the public spaces. You're safe there. Mm-hmm. Nobody will respond to you. So you have the time and the safety that you need to kind of case out the level and plan your moves and figure out your way in, and then you can kind of dive in and out of that place whenever you need to leave the public space. And to tie into that, we have these social engineering sequences where you have to convince a guard at a checkpoint, for example, in the storyline missions, that you are supposed to be there, and that will open up new areas of the level as public space so that you can move around there freely.
Interesting. So you can basically go from, you know, combat or cell focus back to social and back and forth, you know, as the need arise.
Yeah, that's the idea, yeah.
Cool. And now, obviously the game's in early access, so talking too much about the future may be a little early at this point, but in terms of like the overall development of the game, how big of a game are you looking at or hoping to develop through Clandestine as it continues in early access?
The early access, I mean, it was actually reasonably close to release when we put it up on early access, or rather it was close to being sort of content complete. Mm-hmm. I think we're looking at a release date within the next couple of months.
Okay.
The thing is, a lot of the development is despite the early access, it's happening sort of secretly because we don't want to spoil the storyline, mm-hmm. as mentioned. So we have these four challenge maps, and then we have 8 storyline missions, including the intro tutorial level.
Mm-hmm.
Each of which is like an hour and a half long. Some of them consist of 2 to 3 scenes or levels. So, I mean, the game, when it's done, will be roughly 3 times as large as it is on early access right now. And we'll be adding that in like major, I think, 2 major chunks. So you're getting a bunch of content at the same time instead of trying to add it as a trickle.
Okay. Now, another part of early access and building the game up, it has a lot of people are wondering about like post-release support or post-release additions. Are there any plans to continue working on Clandestine after it comes out of early access? Or once it's out, you guys are, you know, basically done with accepting to, you know, bugs and any kind of like technical issues?
Well, we have elaborate plans for, you know, extra missions and free content updates and more gadgets and more features and that kind of stuff. Ultimately, we have a smaller set of things that we'll be doing no matter how well the game does.
Mm-hmm.
And then further development will need to depend on how big a success it is. If it sells a ton of copies, then obviously we'll divert a lot of resources to adding extra content, both for free and paid.
Mm-hmm.
And if it ends up performing a bit worse than we're hoping and expecting, then, you know, we'll leave it at the minimum expected, which I still think is going to be not a disappointment to people. And then we'll maybe hopefully get to make a sequel someday.
Okay, cool. And I just have a few more general gameplay questions, and then we'll begin to wrap things up. Now, I was wondering, could you go into a little bit more detail about what does, like, the hacker do, or what are their options available to assist the spy in terms of getting through each level?
Yeah, right now you have various different objects throughout the game world you can hack. The spy will need to rely on the hacker for opening locked security doors, disabling surveillance cameras. We have laser grids in the game right now, though not in any of the early access, so I guess there's a tiny spoiler there.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these various things that you need to do to sort of let the spy progress. In addition, you have a few environmental things you can do to neutralize enemies. At the moment, we have steam pipes that you can overload, which kills anyone caught in the blast, and we have transformers that you can also overload, which acts as proximity mines that knock characters out with a zap when they get clear.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to this, what we're working on right now is our support asset system. At the moment, they are in early access in 2 ways. We have dead drops, which are, you know, support characters that can kind of place health or ammo for the spy in the game world, and we have bribes that are, you know, they call up an enemy and go, okay, it's time, and mm-hmm. then the enemy will ignore the spy if they see her. We are planning to add a bunch of those. Ultimately, we'll see how many we have time for, but we have a large list of support assets that we really want to add, so you have plenty of options for what to do.
Okay. Besides the guards, are there any threats to the hacker, like someone trying to hack them or having to deal with some other issues that can basically mess with the hacker's play?
Yeah, every level except for a couple of storyline missions have they have the system admin roaming the network. It's also in early access right now. Mm-hmm. So the system admin is kind of moving around semi-randomly, doing routine work on the network. It's a little avatar sort of that moves on the network grid. Mm-hmm. And they tend to get in your way a lot when you're trying to get somewhere in particular to crack a security door or crack a computer to read the emails or something. You'll have to like try and bypass the system admins. And every time you do something on the network that attracts attention, such as cracking a door or a PC, then the admin will go there to investigate what just happened. And if they catch you, on the actual grid, mm-hmm. they will chuck you off the network. You'll have to wait for a while the computer reboots or reconnects. And everything you've done, like cracking the doors and disabling cameras and so on, all of that will be reset and the passwords will be changed and so on.
Okay, cool. All right, I think with that, just a few more questions. I guess one that I'm just wondering for you, Jonas, is in terms of like the mechanics and design, as you said, right now, while the game's in early access, you have the challenge maps and you have story coming later on. Are there any like major mechanics or systems not yet in Clandestine that will be coming in the next few months or so?
Yeah, the main one is the conversation system, right?
Okay.
We use that for the social engineering sequences, and we also have this almost adventure game style sections between each mission where you get to walk around in the headquarters and talk to the boss and the analysis chief and so on and so forth. So we have this RPG style branching dialogue system that you'll be familiar with from all sorts of other games like Alpha Protocol or Mass Effect or so on. Mm-hmm. And that has a bunch of content. Right now we're in the process of recording the voiceover for that, which is obviously taking a lot of my time. So once we have that in, we'll put it in the storyline missions and then release a few of those so you can see what that's about. But that stuff is never going to be in the challenge maps because they're designed to be mm-hmm. less story-based and more replayable. But we think that'll definitely be a big part of selling the spy fantasy because then, you know, bluffing and maintaining your cover and kind of tricking people through social means, that'll become a big part of the game as well.
Cool. Now, another question that I'm sure I have to ask for the fans listening is, in terms of the pricing of Clandestine, I see on Early Access that right now it's priced at $30. When the game is released, are you guys planning on lowering or changing the price at all?
It'll be raised a little bit. Right now we're selling it at a 10% discount from the final price. Mm-hmm. I think I only know it in euro. I think it's like 27 euro right now, and then it's going to be 30 when it's released. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty much it. I mean, we didn't, you know, I suppose we might have wanted to lower the price even further for early access. I don't know quite what we expected there, but we just felt that because, you know, the early access key is going to translate into a full game key, we didn't want to lower the price too much so you'd get this massive effort that we're putting into it almost for free. I mean, I definitely think that the game will be worth substantially more than 30 euros when it's done, but that's what we will be selling it for.
Interesting. Yeah. And the debate about game pricing, that's a whole nother topic that we could spend a lot of time on. But it's really interesting to hear from developers like yourself, Jonas, and others who are trying to figure out like the best price for their games. We've seen some developers like yourself want to go for the higher prices because they feel that the game is interesting, it's something unique, and it warrants that price, while other developers go for the lower end, like $10 to $15, where they feel it's more acceptable or it's easier to get an audience with that. But it's always a risk in terms of how much do you price your game. Do you price it too much that people don't want it? Or do you price it too little that you're not able to make a profit or benefit from it?
Yeah, and I mean, there's also the possibility that you price it too low so that people don't want it. I mean, there's a certain sort of gut reaction that goes, oh, if it's only selling for $10, then it's probably this little small game. It's not mm-hmm. going to be that long. It's not going to be that involving. It's not going to be that polished. I'm not interested, you know.
Yeah.
So you need to signal with your pricing what kind of game you're making, how good is it, how polished is it, mm-hmm. how much enjoyment can people expect to get out of that. But at the same time, you know, only the huge AAA companies that build hype for months can get away with, you know, maybe pricing the game what they think it's genuinely worth. I mean, I think we all want to charge $60 for our game because that's what we all feel like our games are worth, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And another good point there about trying to get that price. Again, as you said, if you price it too low, then people are going to assume like, oh, you know, you spend 2 months on this game, it's going to be crap.
But exactly.
Yeah, that's a really good point about spelling the information out. I think that's a major point that separates the bad early access from the good ones. The best early access titles are ones that pretty much laid out completely clear. Okay, this is where the game's at. This is what you're buying. This is what we're working on. And this, and this is going to be in the final version. And, you know, that's it. You don't want to leave things to the customer's imagination when you're basically asking them to gamble with their money.
No, exactly. Though at the same time, of course, mm-hmm. you know, with Conquistador, we ended up adding a bunch of stuff that we weren't actually planning to simply because we found that we suddenly had the time. We were mm-hmm. talking about all these stretch goals, and we didn't actually achieve those stretch goals on the Kickstarter, but we still ended up adding them anyway, much mm-hmm. to everyone's surprise. So, I mean, it's difficult to predict exactly how things are going to turn out. You know, sometimes unexpected things happen.
Okay. All right, I think with that, Jonas, we can begin to wrap things up. It's been a great conversation. I think we could probably sit here and talk for a few more hours, but I don't want to keep you too late.
Sure.
All right. So my final questions then for you, I guess the first one is, in terms of the release date for Clandestine, you said that it's going to be in a few months. For the fans listening, do you have any like set time, or is it just still going to be like a few months? I think I saw on the Steam forums you're hoping for like around April.
Yeah, that's still what we're aiming for. And I think if I say anything other than that, Alex will kill me.
All right. And in terms of releasing the game, right now, obviously, it's on Early Access and Steam. Are you guys planning on releasing it on any other platforms like GOG, Humble Bundle, or will it remain on Steam?
Well, for now, for the foreseeable future, we're just focusing on Steam. Mm-hmm. With Conquistador, we had kind of a scattershot approach where we were trying to hit every single conceivable platform, and that ended up being an amazing amount of work for us. Just kind of every time we had a patch, we had to put it out on 8 different platforms. Mm-hmm. So for now, I think we just want to focus on Steam, and then we'll see how the game does when it's released, basically.
Okay. And one other question regarding the multiplayer that I forgot to ask, but I'm sure a lot of people are wondering. In terms of like actual connectivity, is this going to be server-based, direct IP, or something else?
At the moment, it's server-based. Mm-hmm. We're looking into other options, but it's very likely that at release, it's going to be server-based, and then we'll see what happens sort of post-release.
Awesome. All right. I think with that, my final question for you, Jones, is do you have any final thoughts or anything you'd like to say to the fans listening to end the cast on?
I would say, I mean, this sounds a bit self-serving, but I would say don't discount early access games just for being early access. Mm-hmm. I think that it's a platform that has tons of potential, and try and remember some of the experiences you may have had with mods and following along there and helping to shape their development. I think there's really a lot to be gained from that, a lot of satisfaction as a player and a lot of potential for really working together with your players as a game developer. I think it's a fantastic platform, and I'm really sad that it's currently being, that it's generating so much skepticism.
Yeah, good point to end on, Jones. I think that should probably be its own discussion, talking more about the past, present, and future of crowdfunding. Because that is another topic where a lot of developers have different opinions on.
Yeah, of course.
All right. So with that, we're going to wrap things up for the Perceptive Podcast. Jonas, it was definitely a pleasure meeting you today. Clandestine sounds very interesting. I can't wait to check it out. And, of course, whatever you guys are doing next with Expeditions, I'm sure will be a great title to keep an eye on.
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Yep, not a problem. So, for those of you listening, we're going to end things for this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. If you would like to contribute to Game Wisdom, we have several options available. To be a future podcast guest or submit a guest piece to the site, you can find all the information and guidelines under Submissions Wanted. For our ongoing Patreon campaign to secure monthly funding, you can find that under the Patreon banner on the front page. And for any game developers listening, we are always on the lookout for more panelists for future roundtables. If you would like to be considered an applicant for that, just shoot me an email. And last but not least, make sure to check out my Twitch channel and YouTube page, where you can find Let's Plays and video analysis of various titles. The Twitch channel can be found under my ID, which is GW Bicer. So, thanks again for tuning into this episode, and we will catch you again next time. Take care, everybody.